Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the sixth sessional meeting of the Faculty of Actuaries for 2007/8. Special welcome to all our guests present. I know there are some guests present tonight. For all our guests, do please feel free to join in the discussion. We'd be most glad to hear from you in the discussion on this evening's paper. Minutes of the meetings of the fifth sessional meeting of the 2007 session held on 18th February 2008 in the Merchants House of Glasgow, which have been posted on the website. No comments have been received, therefore they are taken as approved, and I have signed those minutes. An MP3 file of the meeting will be posted on the website. You are reminded that there is a register which you should sign should you wish to record your attendance for CPD. This is for verification purposes. You are still required to log the CPD yourself on the website. I think that's all the opening housekeeping. I was going to say welcome to this meeting on St. Patrick's Day, but I have been informed today is the first 17th of March for many, many years. That is not St. Patrick's Day because St. Patrick's Day is not allowed to fall in a holy week. And St. Patrick's Day was, in fact, last Saturday. So you learn something every day. So there you go. Anyway, as has become a tradition, I give you a brief update on what's happened since the last sessional meeting. I think the one point which may have escaped the notice of those who are not intimately involved in the running of the profession is that we did in fact adopt a new structure with effect from the 1st of March. Practice boards have now been replaced by practice executive committees and so on. This new structure reflects our renewed focus on supporting members throughout their careers now that the technical guidance responsibility has moved to the Board for Actuarial Standards and some other things. I was planning to announce towards the end of this meeting the holding on the 27th of March of a consultation meeting about the proposed merger with the Institute. However, this afternoon we have received a requisition of a special general meeting signed by 10 fellows in terms of Rule 19. We will take advice on the validity of this requisition. Assuming it is valid, we will almost certainly aim to hold the consultation meeting that was going to be held on the 27th of March on the same afternoon or evening as the requisition meeting. Whether that day can now still be as early as the 27th of March, I'm not sure. I think that remains to be seen. So I think it's a case of watch this space for when we will be holding meetings concerning the proposed merger. So I now move on to the subject of the meeting this evening, which is variable annuities, and we have the group of authors led by Colin Ledley. Don't mean any disrespect to any of the authors, but I have been criticised in the past for reading out CVs at too great a length, so please forgive me if I just quote a line or two from each of the CVs of the six authors. Colin Ledley is Chief Risk Officer and Group Chief Actuary at Standard Life. As such, he's responsible for the risk management, compliance and actuarial functions across the Standard Life group. Gary Finkelstein is a principal and the European practice leader of the financial risk management practice at Milliman. He has been leading Milliman's European service offerings involving new product, asset liability management, and now more recently, hedge design work. Alan Ritchie joined Standard Life in 1999 as a mathematics graduate from Durham University. He qualified as a fellow of the faculty in 2003, has worked in a number of roles across the company. He now leads Standard Life's Guaranteed Income Project and also the design of various tools to support advisors in giving holistic retirement advice. And it has been suggested that he and I have been sat side by side so that you can see if you can detect a family resemblance. Ken Sue is a pricing actuary with Standard Life, focusing on pricing of life and pension products with financial guarantees. He has a first-class honours degree from London School of Economics and an MSc in Actuarial Management with a distinction from the Cass Business School. Colin Wilson is a senior consultant at Edinburgh-based specialist financial risk consultancy Barry & Hibbert. There he leads the work on the modelling and management of risk for annuity and with-profits business. He has a BA and MA in mathematics from Cambridge University, is a fellow and member of Council of the Institute of Actuaries and chairman of the Actuarial Professions Finance, Investment and Risk Management Board, which of course, I presume this CV was written before the 1st of March, so because that board of course no longer exists. Dermot Corrie, who is not attending this evening, is Managing Director of Life Strategies, a firm of actuarial consultants based in Dublin. He is a Fellow of the Society of Actuaries in Ireland and a Fellow of the Institute of Actuaries. He has advised a number of companies who sell variable annuities throughout Europe. So, those are the very brief extracts from the CVs of the six authors of this evening's paper. I now invite Colin Ledley, as the leader of the group, to introduce the topic. Over to you, Colin.
I've got a very short presentation just to introduce some of the highlights of the paper and also to try and suggest some areas where we might focus the discussion as we go through the paper. The last time that I presented on this subject was in September last year at a seminar at the Barbican in London. The title of that seminar was The Next Big Thing, and this working group was presenting some of its initial findings and setting out broadly the structure of the paper that we hoped to produce. The Next Big Thing was the title, and I think an expectation of all the people participating in that event was that variable annuities would be a very significant development within the UK. It was seen as a product line that bridges the gap left by the decline of with-profits business and defined benefit pension schemes. We had seen remarkable growth in the product in the USA and Japan, and that's set out in the paper. We've also seen a large number of product launches happening in the UK and throughout Europe, and many companies using variable annuities as a product design and platform to expand throughout multiple countries with a broadly consistent product design and methodology supporting their launch in many locations throughout Europe. The authors certainly think that the prospects for the product in the UK and indeed the rest of the Europe is very significant, that this could be a massive growth area for many life assurance companies and is an exciting product that actuaries have an important role to play in. Within the paper, we've looked at a sample product design. There are many different applications of the techniques that are used to produce a variable annuity, and in many ways you could view the topic of the paper as a toolkit that actuaries and life companies can use to produce a wide range of different guarantees. But we decided to focus on one specific product area because we felt it was one most likely to have significant growth in the UK and really demonstrated many of the attractive features that could be generated through the use of sophisticated hedging techniques. The product we looked at was guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefits. And under this product, which would be a single premium to a pension product such as a SIP, would provide, for example, at age 65, a guaranteed 5% income for life. Within the product design, we've modelled some features which are common in a number of the launches that have occurred so far, such as annual step-up options, whereby the guarantee increases if investment performance has justified it in the initial 10-year period by up to 15% per annum. The product we modelled has an equity backing ratio of 60%. Clearly, when products are launched in practice, they may well have a different range of options available to the customer. Our modelling has focused on the 60% equity backing ratio. And having modelled the expected economic cost of the guarantee that we've described, we have produced a product where the charge offered to the customer has a cost of 0.75% per annum. We then looked at, in Chapter 6, the outcomes for the customer and tried to assess the degree to which we felt this might be an attractive product. We looked at a number of different scenarios which are described within the paper. Particularly, we drew out two simulations, which, if you look at the distribution of potential returns, sit at the 10th and the 90th percentile. The one you see in front of you at the moment is clearly the adverse scenario, where fund performance is poor and where customers are withdrawing funds from their product on a regular basis. You'll see that under both income drawdown and the variable annuity product, that the fund is exhausted by between age 80 and 85, illustrating some of the dangers in a product without guarantees. You clearly see also the dotted line at the top, which provides a constant level on which the guarantee is based, demonstrating that in this very adverse scenario, that the product has the potential to give substantially better outcome than, for example, an unprotected income drawdown product. Clearly, the position will be somewhat different if economic returns are much more favourable. And in this product, at the 90th percentile in the distribution, we see the outcome of very good returns. The drawdown fund does better than the variable annuity fund through the application of the regular charges to the product. And just visible at the start of the projection period is some increase in the guaranteed base, demonstrating that the product delivers an increase in income in the early years of the product. We then looked at the range of potential outcomes by looking at the full distribution of stochastic outcomes produced by our model. And through the income drawdown product, you can see a range of potential outcomes, but most notable is at the more adverse points in the distribution, that there is a real risk that income to the customer will fall sharply. And you could see that potentially the expectations and needs of that customer are not being met in those scenarios. By contrast, the variable annuity product does provide a guarantee to the income and a much more confined range of potential outcomes. Clearly, the top level of outcomes are less good than the unguaranteed product, but we have managed through the product design to remove the most adverse potential outcomes for the customer. And we see a mean line and a median line of income that would be expected on average to increase from the initial level and therefore provide potentially attractive returns for the customer, giving guaranteed income but also giving some potential for upside returns should the equity performance on the underlying portfolio do well. We've looked at the product, at the pricing of the guarantee, and at the time we started the modelling and based the various economic factors at the middle of last year, the assessed cost was 0.49% per annum for the guarantee charge. Clearly, most offices on top of that would add additional margin, and hence we've modelled a 0.75% total charge to the customer for the actual guarantee. We've shown some sensitivities in the product to falling interest rates as far as the price is concerned, to changes in equity volatility and to different longevity assumptions, and clearly the price will vary quite substantially according to different economic circumstances, and I'll come back to that point shortly. We then tried to look in some of the later chapters at the stresses and the economic cost of the guarantees, and through this table I don't think we need to look at the detail in any at all, but really just to stress that on the unhedged basis, there is substantial potential loss to a life office offering this product. Through a number of the scenarios, a figure of the order of 2,000 in the 10,000 in the 100,000 guaranteed product, and in a combined worst case scenario, 6,000 is the loss. Through various different types of hedging mechanism, that can be substantially reduced. And we've demonstrated through a delta rho vega hedging that the potential losses, whilst not totally eliminated through our modelling, are very, very substantially reduced. And hence, the office can offer these valuable guarantees with much reduced risk. We've also looked at the distribution of profit and loss over time, another way of looking at the risk on the product. And again, we see substantial variation on this chart over time of the potential outcome for the office in offering this type of product. And again, not surprisingly, if we put hedging in place, then the outcomes will be through a much more fine distribution than in the unhedged scenario. We summarised in the paper the potential capital requirements of the product and make no apology for the answer being different under a number of under two different methodologies. Inevitably, the model used and the type of approach adopted will lead to differing results, but it does indicate that with an unhedged position, the potential losses that an office would experience are very substantial, and that through sophisticated hedging, there is the opportunity to reduce those to much more acceptable levels for the life office. We then, in one of the later chapters, also look at some of the regulatory constraints in the product. So we have, I think, formed a view as authors that the product offers very substantial benefits for a consumer, but there are complexities within the UK that make the adoption of the product perhaps more challenging than in the US or Japan, where it has seen such phenomenal success. And in particular, we've drawn out a couple of examples within the paper where the application of GAD maximum and minimum limits start to constrain the outcome of the product and really start to cause, I think, issues with what should be a relatively simple product and forcing more complex, potentially, design for the product. For example, if there were poor investment returns and customers are withdrawing income from the product, then it could be that the GAD max falls below the guaranteed income, which could constrain the pension, or alternatively, the GAD minimum level could increase above the guaranteed income, forcing payments higher than the guaranteed level, and ultimately through the product design, forcing the guaranteed level to fall. Again, not desirable features for the product. It's worth noting that the last 9 months have been very volatile in the markets, and the last few days have been further examples of that. So as we started our modelling, the FTSE index was sitting at 6,600. A few days ago it was at 5,700, and I believe today it's fallen further than that level. Certainly that equity market volatility emphasises the advantage that a guaranteed product offers to the end customer. We have, however, also seen very high volatility and falling bond yields. And to illustrate the price of our sample product design, if we were pricing it on the 7th of March, the price, the economic price for the guarantee would have moved to 0.96%, almost 1%, almost double what it would have been previously. So what topics might we want to encourage today in the discussion? Well, as I've said, the authors are extremely optimistic about the prospects for the product. We believe that there will be further launches of this product design within the UK and potentially throughout Europe. Is our optimism justified? What are the views from the floor in terms of where the product will go? What sorts of designs will feature within the UK and beyond? Is there a genuine consumer benefit from these products? Well, the authors, I think, believe that there is. We hope that we've demonstrated that the outcomes from the product are quite attractive for a wide range of consumers and add to the toolkit that will be available to consumers and advisors developing products within the UK. Will the domestic companies in the UK succeed in this market? The product requires some very sophisticated hedging techniques which have been used extensively in overseas markets like the USA. And a number of the companies that have entered the UK market have come from the USA and used this as their platform for developing propositions. Will those companies be successful, or will the established companies be able to develop the techniques sufficiently robustly and with sufficient volume to be able to succeed in this market? Will hedging techniques perform as they're intended in stream market conditions? Inevitably, as we model the results from the product, they come through demonstrating good performance of the guarantees. But as we've seen in the last 9 months, markets can do unexpected things. And will there be conditions at which extreme conditions, perhaps seizing up of derivatives markets, for example, cause real difficulties for those offering these products and make it difficult for the hedging to still remain effective and exposing companies to unintended risk and potentially loss? We've highlighted the potential constraints of legislation on the product design, and again, would be very interested in thoughts from the audience. Is this really a constraint on those that are looking to develop products in this area? Are there practical suggestions that would help overcome those? Are there changes to legislation that would support the product more effectively? And finally, we've made some fairly bold statements about actuaries having a wide range of skills and perhaps better suited than many other professionals to develop products with their knowledge of mortality, of persistency risk, of market risk, and using those skills to look holistically at all the risks that this product is trying to protect the consumer against. Are we sufficiently well equipped, or are we falling behind in some of the modern techniques that are needed to develop this product? And with that, I open up for discussion, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Colin. I now invite Ruth Barrett of Aegon to open the discussion.
Good afternoon. Firstly, I'd like to thank the authors for producing this paper. Clearly, a lot of hard work has gone into its production. The authors have provided an introduction to the product, followed by a description of the international markets and the current state and prospects for UK and wider Europe. By using the simplified product example that Colin described, the authors illustrate features, management and issues with variable annuity. I will say VA for short, product category. The authors start by looking at the international term variable annuity, one that can create confusion in the UK, being neither variable nor an annuity. I personally prefer simpler language, for example, guaranteed products. The authors then go on to explain the terminology for typical classes of guarantees. In section 3, the authors look at the UK market and why the time is right for such guarantees. As Colin's already mentioned, they focus on the pension's decumulation phase, looking at some kind of third way between annuities and income drawdown. As they mentioned in their paper, there could be significant potential in other areas, such as group personal pensions and single premium bonds, and for other guarantees, such as death benefits or capital guarantees. The authors identify key challenges to the market as ensuring that design meets customer needs subject to legislation, demonstrating value for money, and balancing simplicity with a desire to compete with the most attractive features. In terms of value for money, there's been a lot said to date on whether the value of the price of guarantees is too high, and I think that if VAs are to succeed, we must demonstrate their value. Analysis into customer preferences could help tailor guarantees and identify those guarantees that must have the highest perceived value. Small mistakes by commentators in analysing the value of such products can cause a lot of damage, particularly if there's no stochastic modelling involved in the analysis. A barrier for the traditional insurer will be the sales challenge where there's a range of products. If the VA is harder to explain and not a one-visit sale, then salespeople are perhaps more inclined to go back to products that they know well, as it's an easier sale for them. In section 4, the authors describe how VAs have developed in a number of international markets, focusing predominantly on the USA and Japan, which have the largest markets. And considering whether there will be similar success in the UK and in other parts of Europe, it's interesting to compare the situation with those drivers in the US and Japan. Certainly, we have the same concerns about the ageing population and state benefits. The authors then go on to create a simplified product by describing the design and basis. A simple product is a very useful tool in explaining the features of VAs. In section 6, the authors compare the VA contract with a comparable income drawdown contract for both the good and bad economic scenario, as Colin was showing you earlier. And the authors thus demonstrate the removal of downside risk and the benefit of some upside with the guaranteed product. In 6.5, the authors look at the FSA's requirements to treat customers fairly and the support that will be required for distributors. In 6.5.8, they make the point that full training of advisors and the development of advice tools will be required before the advice system can confidently handle the full complexity of product features. I think this will be a real challenge to providers, and there's a risk that with guarantees varying between companies, distributors will struggle to make valid comparisons between the different features and the price. In section 7, the authors consider pricing methods. They use a market-consistent valuation and discuss assumptions, including a dynamic lapse assumption. The lack of credible policyholder behaviour data for lapses and for other behaviours is a challenge, and I'm sure that there will be much more analysis on this going forward. Another challenge with VAs is the setting of the price, as described in 7.6. Due to the dependence of profit on economic conditions, fairly infrequent price changes will lead to volatile new business profit. Ways suggested in the paper to combat such volatility are loading a risk premium into the price and pre-hedging market risk exposures. I'd be interested to know the extent to which these methods have been used and had success in other markets, and whether the authors envisage a situation with more frequent pricing reviews in the future. In Chapter 8, the authors give a useful coverage of the UK and Irish reserve requirements for the product and give an overview of accounting considerations. VAs see insurers take on a much wider range of risks in a single product line than has been seen recently. In Chapter 9, the authors explore the various risk exposures and possible risk management solutions. They then go on to look at in detail at the key risk, that is market risk, in Chapter 10. Market risk is complex, and the authors provide a detailed study of the risk management issues that is clear and easy to read. The dynamic versus static hedge versus combination hedge arguments are thought-provoking, and the numerical examples demonstrate the substantial benefits of hedging on risk capital. Given recent market events, even today, the point on considering the extreme market and financial conditions is well made, and further research in this area would be welcome. Chapter 11 looks at pensions legislation and the extent to which existing regulations on GAD rates and on death benefits constrain current VA proposals for pensions products. I echo the author's comments on a desire to study ways in which legislation could be developed to work for all parties. Turning to conclusions, I agree that variable annuities offer valuable guarantees that meet real customer needs. They provide customers with both the control over their investments and certainty from underlying guarantees. Variable annuities are a complex product category with many areas of challenge, and I also agree that actuaries are well placed to play key roles. We traditionally have the expertise in managing longevity and behavioural risks, and with the availability of computing power, that means we can now use more effective risk management techniques such as dynamic hedging. I'd like to congratulate the authors on their comprehensive paper. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ruth. I am now going to throw the meeting open to comments from the floor. The proceedings will be recorded, so I'd ask all contributors to state your name clearly. There are microphones at various points in the room, and there's also roving microphones available. And if you're speaking from written notes, may I ask that at the end of the meeting you pass a copy of those notes to Mary McIntyre, who's sitting at the corner of the front row here. So, can I invite comments from contributions from the floor, please?
As someone who's been involved with variable annuity products, both from the perspective of a provider and in giving advice to providers, I think this is an extremely helpful and timely paper, which I hope will be the start of authoritative work on this subject here in the UK. I have to express a certain amount of surprise that the authors have not chosen to take the opportunity to introduce some UK-centric terminology to this debate, instead opting to use their own definition of variable annuity to make this label more meaningful in a UK context. I would argue that it is neither the variability nor the annuitisation aspects that define this type of business. It is both the guarantees and the way those guarantees are being delivered that provide the key to defining this business. For me, it's useful to compare these fundamental guarantees with other guarantees that have historically been provided in the UK. Whilst this is something of a generalisation, in the UK we've tended to see guarantees provided through simple investment management techniques. Whether we're looking at with-profit business or any other type of product with guarantees, the starting point is to match guarantees with fixed interest investments, thereby providing certainty that the issuer of the guarantee will find themselves ultimately holding the assets that will honour the guarantee. And the result can often be that the investor does not get the equity exposure that they thought they were going to get. And that's where the difference lies with this business, and it's a fundamental distinction. The customer gets the exposure that they choose, and they pay an explicit charge in order to provide this guarantee. This could be regarded as the insurance route to providing investment guarantees. The authors have chosen to focus the paper on the pensions market. This is very understandable given the natural link between guarantees and retirement income, as well as allowing consideration of the unique challenges that the UK pension system provides. But it would be wrong to discount the non-pension savings market too lightly. After all, half of the first six products offering these types of guarantee in the UK have been investment bonds, and there are clear signs that this market is in need of new forms of investment guarantee. During the heyday of the with-profit bond, the vast majority of all investment bonds sold had some form of guarantee. Last year, the proportion of investment bonds sold with some form of guarantee sat at around 15%. This certainly suggests the lack of the right product to satisfy demand for investment guarantees. Section 332 of the paper rightly highlights the challenge of communicating value for money for these guarantees, a task made all the more difficult by this fundamental difference in the way these guarantees are provided. Another feature of more traditional guarantees has been the lack of transparency over the charge the customer is paying for the guarantee, often obscured by the fact that the true cost is not an explicit charge, but the loss of potential investment performance through not being invested in equity assets. Promoting guarantees that have an explicit charge to consumers, and perhaps more importantly advisors, therefore, presents two issues. Firstly, the existence of the explicit charge, and secondly, the magnitude of it. The paper provides an excellent analogy for this situation in section 911. If US providers in 2000 to 2002 wrongly perceived the risk they were facing through being unhedged as negligible, is it any wonder that consumers and advisors here in the UK often consider the explicit guarantee charges to be higher than their own perceived value of that guarantee? Section 428 of the paper highlights research suggesting that one of the reasons for the popularity of this business in the US are transparency and flexibility. Our UK experience to date would appear to question whether the transparency angle has successfully made it over here. Section 6 of the paper provides some very interesting and detailed analysis of the potential benefits of the sample product from the consumer's perspective. But if we need stochastic projections in order to understand how the product would operate across a range of likely scenarios, I wonder what this says about consumers' and advisors' abilities to understand fully the detailed operation of the product. We should bear in mind that this is deliberately a simple product, and not only have the more complex product features been omitted, but so has the interaction with the pensions framework. It's probably unsurprising that stochastic model-based illustration and advice tools have already been developed for some of these products, and it's a clear indicator that this area needs some careful consideration. Finally, I'd like to make an observation on section 11.6 concerning death benefits. I don't believe that the existence of or the ability to provide guaranteed death benefit after the age of 75 is in itself a credible argument for changing such an entrenched government position on the inheritability of pension funds. Variable annuities are not, after all, the only retirement income vehicle that would or could be constructed to have a payment on death. But I would wish the authors luck in trying to pursue this. Thank you.
Sorry, just before you go, could I ask you to say who you are, please?
Yes, apologies for that. Paul Challis.
Okay. Now, I should have said at the start as well that we're playing this very much by ear to the degree to which the authors actually wish to respond as we go along or wait until the end. So I'm just going to assume that we will continue to take comments from contributions from the floor unless and until one of the authors indicates to me that they wish to respond immediately to a point that has been made. So, can I invite the next contribution, please? Well, perhaps while people are gathering their thoughts, at this stage I'm often frantically thinking about a question myself, but I don't have to this evening because we have a written contribution. So I'll read out now a written contribution from Chris Barnard. I would like to touch on three topics: pricing and profit testing of variable annuities, hedging platforms and economic risk capital. It is very important that actuaries carry out pricing and profit testing, have appropriate and up-to-date experience about local markets, pricing techniques, what is important to model and what is not, the effects of hedging, and insurance company accounting. We also need to consider the sensitivity of profits to market parameters, including dynamic policyholder behaviour, and an understanding of how the product will be marketed and sold, so we know what type of policyholder behaviour to expect. Furthermore, the strength and impact of management levers also needs to be considered. For example, what ability does the company have to adjust fees, fund allocation options, etc., and what is the company's philosophy on using those levers? Turning to hedging platforms, once again, the experience of the team designing and managing the platform is critical. They require expert capital market experience, trading knowledge and expertise, and an understanding of insurance company accounting. The platform should be flexible enough to incorporate new benefits, hedge instruments and hedging strategies, and have the flexibility to trade or not trade depending on exposures, etc. Hedge effectiveness reporting should be integral, and the platform should automatically incorporate agreed risk limits. Calculation efficiency and system capabilities should be considered well in advance. Dynamic hedging requires millions of calculations per day that must be performed quickly enough so that your information is not stale by the time you adjust your hedge positions. The platform should also be market consistent. We have to consider the frequency and method for calibrating assumptions such as volatility surfaces, risk-free rates, correlations, etc. Any platform should be mock tested, e.g. the ability to try out a new strategy or hedge program before actually implementing it live. As mentioned, we also need ongoing independent hedge efficiency reporting that compares predicted results with actuals, e.g. given what happened, what did the hedge program predict would be the outcome, and how close was that to actuality? Additional testing would include, for example, testing scenarios that have not yet happened, or using the model to price market observable securities. Finally, backups and controls should be pre-planned against, for example, redundancy in personnel and systems. Regarding economic risk capital, the main components of risk capital are financial risks, equity, interest rate, and credit, and non-financial risks, mortality, policyholder behaviour, and business and operational risks. Shocks to these should be tested in aggregate and individually. An analysis and reflection of hedge efficiency, given a chosen hedging strategy and track record, if any, should also be included. Beyond the technical aspects of these calculations, there is an important point regarding modelling. Often, the brute force method, calculating scenarios with scenarios inside them for every product, age, gender, benefit, fund allocation combination, is not possible given system data and time constraints. Therefore, modelling techniques that capture the important components of the risk capital calculation, but not necessarily using the brute force approach, can be invaluable. That concludes the comments, the written comments from Chris Barnard. Right, I wonder, has that given people time to... Roy Sloan. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. My name is Roy Sloan. Impressed as I genuinely am by the high-tech nature of the mathematical modelling used in the sensitivity analysis of the various elements of such new variable annuity products, I thought it might be helpful to offer a few comments from the viewpoint of an actuary who has for many years provided quite a lot of advice to individuals on the decumulation process. As such, and since I don't fall within the category of provider, then I suppose I must be included in what is called, for the purpose of the FSA's Treating Customers Fairly guidance, the distributor category. I thought that was part of a car. However, as this category will typically consist mainly of IFAs, I was particularly struck by the question posed at 6.5.5 as to whether the information given by the provider to such distributors is likely to enable them to understand it enough to give suitable advice. And further at 6.5.8, where it suggested that training of advisors and development of advice tools may be required before IFAs can confidently handle the full complexity of all the product features. I suspect that this is a considerable understatement, as I think Ruth Barrett referred to in her remarks. The point is that the majority of IFAs do not fully understand even the simpler such products that have existed for the last 12 to 15 years, such as income drawdown and unitised annuities, the latter of which include both investment-linked and with-profits annuities. I believe that if IFAs were to have better understanding, then there might be rather less need to develop some of the more complicated products that are now appearing on the market. While stochastic modelling using an esoteric economic scenario generator may be fine and necessary for actuaries on the product development and management side of providers, one needs to adopt a rather more simple approach in providing advice to individual clients. For instance, an array of possible outcomes based on a suitably chosen range of deterministic assumptions. In other words, the answers to a range of what-if questions. By way of a practical example, I generally describe an annuity as being a combination of investment and longevity insurance, whereas under drawdown, the client has to underwrite his own longevity, well, up until age 75 at any rate. I've also found that a useful way of illustrating the concept of mortality drag, as we call it, under drawdown, is to show the cumulative cost to ages up to age 75 of providing death benefit cover that ends up being wasted, which I call the cost of not dying. Many of our IFAs, and likewise our clients, tend to regard annuities as rather a swindle, especially in the event of early death, when the insurance company pockets the lot. However, it's a relatively easy matter to remedy this without the need for some of the complicated new products by the simple device of combining a guarantee period with a spouse's pension arranged on a with-overlap basis. That's one that commences simultaneously with any unexpired part of the guarantee period rather than deferred until the end. So by that means, if a 10-year guarantee is chosen, plus a two-thirds spouse's pension with overlap, then assuming that the spouse will survive for at least 10 years from the outset, there's immediately virtually a guaranteed minimum return of around 17 times the annual annuity. Another obsession of many IFAs, and hence their clients, is their overemphasis under drawdown of the need to avoid inheritance tax on the fund remaining at death, which has led to ever more complex layers of legislation to stamp out actual or perceived abuse. However, it's often the case that purchase of an annuity to provide a core income for life, and which involves no inheritance tax on death, can provide the necessary long-term financial security to enable the client to gift significant other assets to children or grandchildren, which, on survival for more than 7 years, can result in significant and legitimate inheritance tax savings. So my message is, instead of, or as well as, designing ever more complex new products, it may be at least as cost-effective to develop new ways of explaining and marketing the simpler existing products, many of which can, in fact, provide fairly similar results. And in that category, I include the well-proven with-profits annuity, via which at least one actuary in this room hopes to take substantial personal financial advantage of the expected continuing longevity improvement of his cohort. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ronnie. Andrew Smith.
Good evening, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Andrew Smith. I'd like to thank the authors for this paper. I'm going to make a few comments on the hedging, which is in section 10, and particularly the charts, which start on page 54, going on to page 55. Those of you who've been working in this industry longer than I have may remember the guaranteed products of the 1970s, and indeed the report of the Maturity Guarantees Working Party, which I'm pleased to see the authors here reference. The effect of that report, some of you may remember, was to introduce onerous reserving requirements, which more or less killed off the product. So we have to ask what has changed. And I think what has changed is that the 1980 Working Party repudiated the effectiveness of hedging, and of delta hedging in particular. Whereas this paper, I'm pleased to say, embraces it fully. But then they had the advantage here today of nested simulations, which I assume weren't so easily available in the 1970s. So, for example, figure 10.9.5 shows the dramatic improvement in risk management from implementing some fairly simple hedging strategies. Looking at figure 10.9.5, the improvement in variability to me looks too good to be true, and is very much more effective than I've seen in any back testing as a result of trades that have been done and subsequently analysed. I think Mr. Barnard's, the contribution that was read, already made this point about the need to back test, and I think we need to understand exactly why it is that the variability looks so slight in figure 10.9.5 compared to back testing experience. And I think there's two reasons. One is that it appears to be looking only at variability from market risk, and yet in practice policyholder behaviour will change, and policyholder behaviour will be uncertain. So when you set out to hedge a guarantee, you don't know how many policyholders will take advantage of that guarantee. So you're always shooting at a moving target. And so then when you come to hedge how you thought policyholders would behave, and they behave differently, then your hedge doesn't work as well as you thought. And that may explain one aspect of why the hedging appears so effective in this model, perhaps more effective than you'd see in real life. And secondly, what seems to have happened is the authors have constructed a model where volatility surfaces move in parallel, and then they investigate a hedge, a row hedge, row being defined as the sensitivity to a parallel move in volatility surfaces. So it seems to me it's a foregone conclusion that that ought to work. What the authors have tested is their ability to differentiate an option price both numerically and analytically, and getting more or less the same answer. Well, I'm pleased the authors can do that, but we need to be sure that we recognise that's what the figure is demonstrating, and not, for example, any suggestion that the hedge would be quite that effective. There's one more point I'd like to pick up. This is at the end of, on page 57, at the end of 10.9.13, where the authors suggest a detailed study looking at the trade-off between hedging frequently, which reduces the requirement for economic capital, but then hedging less frequently in order to reduce transaction costs. I think that's a splendid idea, and in fact it would have been quite a good idea, I think, to have included that in the section on profit testing, since these are elements of costs which need to be taken into account. The authors may be unaware of a paper that was presented in London at a Staple Inn Actuarial Society on variable annuities a few months ago. And that paper, in fact, gave quite a bit of detail as to how those calculations should be carried out, or could be carried out, both in terms of the cost of the risk capital and also in terms of the transactions cost. So I'd recommend that the authors have a read of that paper, and if they consider it worthwhile, perhaps would like to add it to their list of references. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Can we have the next question or comment from the floor, please? Gentleman right at the back.
Is that working?
Yes.
My name is Roger Knowles. You asked for comments as to the marketability of the product. I think that it's you're looking at the two basic elements of how somebody investing money looks at their product, which is the combination of greed and fear. And I think what you're doing is you're matching the greed element very well, in that the market goes up, the benefit is there. And to a certain extent, you're matching the fear element as well, in that when the market goes down, that your income is protected under your withdrawal scheme. But in my opinion, the one fear which a pensioner has, and is easy to forget in the current environment, but in the past has been highly relevant, the big fear is inflation. And if inflation were to take off to, say, 10-15%, and the stock market were to come right back down, your product does not meet that requirement at all. Now, I admit that most people in the present day would say, oh, well, then inflation's been cured or whatever, and it's no longer a problem. But I can see at some time in the future that then this product will be seen not to have met the genuine need of the pensioner market. And the second point I would make is regarding the hedging. The one thing about this product is that with a guarantee, you're always going to sell much more of it after the market has been very poor, because then the fear element is there. Arguably, when after the market has fallen a long way, the guarantee is far less important to the investor, but he doesn't see it that way. Likewise, when the market's gone soaring up, which is exactly the time you do want the guarantee, people are tending not to bother to take it out. The potential, therefore, is there for you to sell a great deal of this business when the market has come right down, is very low. And as I understand it, you're going to be delta hedging through the use of futures. It seems to me that you could end up buying a whole load of futures, which it turns out the market will then suddenly increase quite rapidly in price. First of all, you don't need. And secondly, potential has been there in the past for this to cause cash flow problems if it is out of if the amount of business you've taken on is swamps everything else you've done. And I think in certain circumstances, the use of future hedging of the market is very low. I think it's something that you should certainly be aware of. That's my 2 points. Thank you.
Hello, is this working?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Thanks very much for those points, and thanks everyone for the points that they've made so far, which have been very helpful for all the authors, I think. One point I would like to make on the inflation point, which I thought was a very valid one, and it's also a relative, an important point when it comes to talking about why people would buy these guarantees in the first place and how do we show the marketability of these products. I think one of the key things is that the guarantee affords you to invest more in equities and property than you otherwise would invest in. So these are assets that traditionally will rise as inflation rises. So in some ways, I'm not saying that this completely answers your point, but in some ways, the fact that you have the guarantee should allow you to invest in assets that do increase more in line with inflation. And the subsequent point is, because these guarantees, unlike with profits annuities and so on that Ronnie was talking about, because these guarantees are flexible and you can turn them off as well as turn them on, what this means is, what if the markets do go up and inflation is very high and equities and so on deliver very well, but then you decide, hold on, stop the bus, I want to buy something that's going to protect me against inflation in the future and give me that longevity protection, etc., in the form of an annuity, then you can do that because you can turn off the guarantee and then buy that annuity at that stage. So I think from a marketability point of view, what I would say is these guarantees give you a bit more flexibility than some of the products that we've had in the past. They give you the higher exposure to equities with the same comfort that you might have had with a lower exposure to equities without the guarantee, and therefore hopefully help to meet some of these points. Yes, agreed. I'm not saying it's a perfect scenario, but I think it does help to mitigate a lot of the risk.
And of course, there is always the possibility of putting in inflation-linked gilts. Amongst the funds which the policyholder can choose to invest in, are funds that can have real assets in there. course, the price of the guarantee will vary depending on the underlying in the fund. Your other point about the use of futures in rising markets is a valid point. It's a correct point. If the markets start rising very, very rapidly and you've been hedging with futures, what happens is the value of the guarantee liability becomes less valuable because the markets have risen, and your short position in futures also becomes less valuable. If you get to the situation where the value of the guarantee liability is negative, and by that I mean the value of the future charges is greater than the value of the future guarantee claims, the advantage of a dynamic hedging approach is that one can dynamically modify the extent of your hedging to reduce the risk of high lapses after markets have risen and closing out on negative futures positions, or if you like, the cash flow strains that occur with margin calls, by adapting your risk management and hedging strategy to have a deductible and essentially put the embedded value as the first line of defense, and the hedging kicks in only when the value of the guarantee liability is effectively zero. I mean, it is a valid point, and but the technology and methodology can deal with it.
Another interesting sort of way to look at these guarantees is from the provider's point of view in terms of sales. So you mentioned, Roger, that perhaps the customers will buy these guarantees more when markets have fallen, which interestingly is exactly the time when sales for traditional savings and pensions products would fall off for a provider. So the fact that you have this kind of extra product feature or product option from a provider's point of view should be a real benefit to sales at times when otherwise you might see a drop off in sales, and therefore it might be a really nice feature from the company's point of view as well as from the individuals.
Okay, can I invite the next contribution from the floor, please? Lady here.
Okay, Catherine Henschel. I just had a few practical comments, really. I've been working with Variable Annuities a bit in continental Europe and here in the UK. And yeah, thank you for the paper. It's been well received and well waited for. And people from Europe are looking actually to this paper and to what's going on in the UK. I think we're well placed in the UK in terms of how we're already set up with reserving, and in terms of reserving and capital and ICA and everything we're already doing in terms of stochastic modelling, does give us a lot of skills in terms of how we can manage the risks for variable annuities. And as we set assumptions and as we do the reserving, I know that the insurers in Europe are looking at what we're doing. On a practical point of view, more than one insurer as well are using quite bespoke hedging solutions. So they would enter into a contract with an investment bank, which basically takes all of the market risk off their books, or takes for a particular tranche of policies. So that's just maybe an alternative solution that maybe doesn't come out so much in the paper, but it is in practice being really looked at and used by insurers. And comments on IT as well. Companies that I've been speaking to, they find that IT is one of their biggest challenges with these, with running, actually having variable annuities sold and in practice to run it. So I think as a profession as well, we can be involved in the IT, be involved in the testing, and as actuaries who are monitoring these programs, be aware of what's going on the IT and the real practical challenges that are there. And just a suggestion as well that maybe as a profession we can proactively offer something in the whole area of marketing these products. Maybe instead of waiting around to be asked to come up with a flyer or do something, maybe we can be thinking about communicating and how the industry can be communicating the benefits of these products to consumers. Thanks.
Okay, can I invite the next, David Hare.
very much, Mr. President. I presume I don't need to repeat my name again. I'd like to start off by showing I'm an actuary and ask a question about some of the numbers. And when you look at table 426, the list of variable annuity writers in the states and their assets under management, then what you find from that is at the end of 05, there was about 1.2 trillion. I presume these are millions of dollars, but I might be just showing my misunderstanding if they're not. But what I did was I compared that number with what I was expecting to see based on what paragraph 423 said, which said that at end of 2000 there was $1 trillion. And then I used 422, the table of sales, to see that there was over 120 or more billion dollars a year. So I was expecting to see about 1.6 trillion or something by the end of 05. So where did the $400 billion go? Or were these just from different sources so you can't really compare them? Because most what I'm interested in is, you know, is there something else happening in the states that these numbers are suggesting that might indicate something about policyholder behavior? The next point, which is sort of following on from this, is that you know, according to the analysis, which I think seems well-founded, that you know, these are very popular and the amount of assets under management and with these guarantees is growing rapidly across the world. What I'm wondering is just what proportion of the market are we now assuming the variable annuity market will be sort of buying up? You know, if you've got one and a bit trillion in the States from several years ago, and then it grows rapidly in Japan, it grows rapidly in Europe, presumably we'll end up in a few years with trillions and trillions of dollars all being secured by, you know, various derivatives and futures bought from a number of investment banks throughout the world. And I just wonder whether there's a natural ceiling, and what the author's views are. Is there a natural ceiling on capacity, or is actually the capacity so much greater that it's not an issue? Because I suppose we have seen in the UK at least one financial institution that built a business model on effectively buying wholesale and then selling on retail, accused of following a reckless strategy when the wholesale market didn't do what it was meant to do. And I wonder, what's the risk that the financial markets won't do what they're meant to do just at the time when a lot of institutions are depending upon them? Will they all be reckless with hindsight, or is that something that is so far into the tail that we don't need to worry about? I really enjoyed the paper. I'm grateful to the authors for the time they spent. It's a very helpful paper. My comments aren't necessarily unenthusiastic about the concept, since it's a concept which looks eminently attractive from some of your graphs, but it's just the practical outworking. I wonder, could you just say a bit more about that? Thanks.
Thank you, David. I don't know if the authors would like to respond immediately.
I will have a go. Essentially, if one doesn't believe in the capital markets, then probably hedging in the capital markets is not for you. But I guess, firstly, I think there's two important themes coming out in the discussion. One is whether the guarantees have a very valuable customer proposition. And then if that's the case, then clearly by selling guarantees, one introduces risk to the insurance company. And is it the insurance company's raison d'etre to sell risk, professionally risk manage risk, and heaven forbid perhaps profit from selling risk? And if that's the case, then shall we embrace the most modern risk management techniques? Now, that's not answering your direct question. The question of how the capital markets operate and whether there's a natural ceiling essentially depends. I mean, there's a great variety of ways you can risk manage these through, and we, you know, through using exchange traded futures, which are collateralized in the exchange, interest rate swaps where liquidity is huge, and if you go very long term, you can go OTC, with OTC options where you have a single counterparty and there'll be a credit risk management issue. I think credit risk never goes away, even if you have collateral on the exchange. But I think what might be worthwhile is I'll consider putting a very short. We didn't include in this paper sort of a description of the operation of the capital markets and how one can get comfortable with the operation of the capital markets in running such a modern risk management program. It is essentially bringing into insurance companies, the technology allows bringing into insurance companies investment banking techniques, and banks are familiar with their businesses lending and credit is their business. And credit risk management is going to be a key component of running these risk management programs, and therefore monitoring your collateral requirements using futures or swaps or individual credit counterparty exposures if you're using options.
Maybe just add from a sort of CRO perspective that I think you've got to think the unthinkable and start thinking what will happen if certain elements of the market stop functioning in the way that we're using to them. What's the worst that could happen to us, and how bad would that be for my institution? And today, if we've got a small amount of variable annuities on the book, probably not a lot. We wouldn't be terribly worried about it. But if in 10 or 15 years' time, our in-force book is dominated by variable annuities, all heavily dependent on the continued existence of active liquid markets, then I think I've got to start thinking what happens if those instruments that I'm dependent on aren't available in the way I've been used to them, and could I live through that? Have I got enough diversity in my range of products that I'm offering that I can survive that, and there isn't this one killer scenario, which perhaps the example that David highlighted was a case, there was a killer scenario out there that hit that institution, and any institution has got to think through its range of exposures and make sure it isn't so exposed to one particular segment of the market.
Thank you. Can I invite the next contribution from the floor, please?
Ewan Munro. I'm not afraid of capital markets. It's a minority interest, but I'm closely watching the Japanese swap market at the moment. And one of the things that, I mean, Andrew Smith said that backtesting is going to be important, and I do think that looking forward at how this product, if it becomes big, might affect the markets you're using to hedge. So the recent days, the Japanese swap market's pivoted around the middle of the curve, so now the 30-year part of the Japanese swap market is yielding 30 basis points less than Japanese governments. And if there's lots of unfunded reach for duration, so you're physically investing your money in funds and UK equities and separately using the derivative market to protect yourself against adverse moves in long-term interest rates, what the market will do to you is it will make sure that swap spreads are very big on short-dated swaps and small or negative on long-dated swaps. That's happening in Japan. And so I do think the balance of this product, among other products, and the supply and demand in the derivative market needs to be thought about very carefully in modelling these risks. The other thing that I think is important is that, for good reasons, this paper, and it's an excellent paper, it looks at the variable annuities and the way to deal with the risks in a sort of hermetically sealed world. Of course, there are very few insurance companies that don't have some exposure to adverse moves in stock markets, long-term interest rates, inflation, and so on. And so I'd be quite interested in the author's view as to how this should be managed within a life company balance sheet that is running a variety of different products and many of the same risks. Do you think it should have its own separate workshop that does this, or should it be something that's handled in the round?
I think the authors are reserving their comment.
We'll have a bash at it anyway. Probably to say we don't know the answer to the question. I think probably the experience has been, and probably look to some of the other authors for assistance in this, perhaps Gary, but my impression is that a lot of companies have sort of looked at this in a sealed box almost and have tried to set up hedging programs which focus on the individual product line. I think the point is well made. That you could take a very different approach and look at it more holistically in terms of all the risks. I think the approach of looking at it in that little portfolio does have the advantage of simplicity in some sense, is that you can focus on a business line, that it can demonstrate its own viability and its own profitability, and you can set up a hedging program that is focused on that business line. I think it does become more complex when you commingle with lots of other types of risks, and in a sense you'd probably need to start demonstrating the benefit from that wider approach. Can you demonstrate that it will be saving, giving you synergies perhaps on the trading that you need to put in place across a wider book? I suspect that some companies will be looking across territories, for example, and looking at managing a variable annuity portfolio globally.
Yeah. I think the other thing I would add to that is your comment about the importance of back testing, and I 100% agree with that. And before one implements and goes live with a hedging program, amongst the scenarios you investigate are historic scenarios, amongst all sorts of other scenarios. But also, even after you've implemented one of the written responses, it's actually mentioned in the paper, I'm not sure the paragraph number, the importance of monitoring the performance and the effectiveness of the hedge as it evolves. And which is essentially backtesting live as well. You know, you're always backtesting even the week after you've actually transacted. It's a key part of both the market and the operational risk management. I'm not too keen to get too involved in Japanese experience, other than to say the general experience of hedging programs globally in the last 6 to 9 months have been relatively volatile, and we've seen all sorts of interesting market conditions. Generally, the hedging programs have all been behaving as expected. Companies who have deliberately or not deliberately had chosen to not fully hedge volatility positions will not be doing as well off in the last 6 to 9 months as companies who were very, very tightly vaguer hedged. That doesn't mean to say that those that are very tightly vaguer hedged are still up over the five-year experience, where realized volatility over the previous 4 years was lighter than market implied. And the same with long-term row interest rate protection. If interest rate curves move in a way, I guess the key part of the risk management is to match the liabilities and the assets, and in particular the row of the liabilities with the row of the assets. And if curves move in a way where assets don't perform well, on the other side the liabilities are reducing in value as well, and so a profit isn't made, which would have been made if interest rates had otherwise moved in favour of the insurance company. And conversely, if risk variables move in an adverse way, causing the liabilities to otherwise be higher than they would have, fortunately we have a row hedge asset in place to protect against the loss that otherwise would have been made. It doesn't fully deal with the specific details of the Japanese experience that you're talking about, but I think hopefully in general terms.
Thank you. Can I invite the next contribution from the floor, please?
My name is Ian Naismith. I'd like to join others in congratulating the authors on a thorough and very wide-ranging paper. I want to pick up on the marketing side, and particularly on Ronnie Sloan's comment about distributor understanding, because I think that is quite a big issue with this product. I think we'd all accept we can't expect distributors to understand the mechanics of how the guarantee works, so we're really looking at how do we explain outcomes to distributors, and then how do they pass these on to their clients. And the starting point for that, I think, has to be an annuity. The FSA will expect, if we're offering a product that isn't fully guaranteed, that we will make a comparison with the product that is guaranteed, the conventional annuity. The authors do point out in the paper that there are differences, for example, in the death benefits, although I think with the current tax structure beyond 75 and death benefits, these are relatively small in the UK. Death benefits beyond 75 outside the annuity have punitive taxation and therefore provide relatively little advantage. If we take the product as it was modelled, the way it's structured is that when you get to 75, your guaranteed income is fixed for life. Starting at 65, you therefore have 10 years of potential growth in your income. And over that 10 years, to catch up with our level annuity, it had to gain around 40% to get from £5,000 to £7,000 a year. Add to that the 5% income, 2.5% in charges, and you're looking at a yearly return of around 11% to catch up with the level of income you're guaranteed with an annuity. And that seems fairly optimistic. Certainly will happen in a minority of circumstances. And I think as part of the marketing of the product, it has to be made clear that if the customer stays with the product, then in most cases, they will have significantly lower income than they would have with an annuity. Alan Ritchie made the point that you wouldn't necessarily stay with this product. If you made some investment gains, then it makes perfect sense to annuitise, perhaps at 75, perhaps a little bit later on. In that case, perhaps the comparison then becomes with going for a straightforward income drawdown, and what are the chances of beating that? And again, using modelling in the paper, it looks out to 75 as if there's something like a 10% chance of having a higher fund with a variable annuity than with income drawdown. So again, the chances are that you are going to lose out slightly compared with going into drawdown. And I think the comparison with the annuity, with not being able or having difficulty matching the income if you stay with the product, and the comparison with drawdown, if you do decide to buy an annuity perhaps at 75 or a little bit later, actually present quite a strong marketing challenge. How can we position this? And I'd be particularly interested to hear the views of the authors of how would they position this, how would they be explaining to distributors what kind of customer this product's aimed at. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Ian. Yeah, very, very good points. And as a potential provider of this product, I think these are exactly the challenges that we will face in the market. So thanks very much for raising them. These are the questions we should be asking ourselves. How do we explain the outcomes versus an annuity? Well, I guess my starting point in terms of, and I realise there are pros and cons, so I'll stick to the pros at this stage. The pros really relate to the fact that versus an annuity, so many people buy an annuity now at age 60 or 65, and yet they're going to live for another 25 or 30 years on average, we think now. So people are living so much longer. Annuities invest in fixed interest. So as actuaries, how often would we tend to advise somebody to invest in fixed interest for a 30-year period? Normally we would suggest for such a long period, unless you're very, very risk-averse, some equity investment in order to try and get that upside potential. Yes, the product design will have to make sense in terms of a product where you're very, very unlikely to ever see that upside potential, won't be very effective versus an annuity. So the product has to give you that potential upside. But I think that's where the key versus an annuity lies. It's to do with that potential upside. Yes, the death benefits mainly before the age of 75. And then I guess the message is around deferring the annuity purchase. So maybe by the time you do get to age 75 and you don't have such a long period left to live, that's about the right time to start thinking about buying an annuity. This product could enable you to invest for equities for longer while still having some protection if things do go very badly wrong. And I think that's really some of the arguments that I put forward versus an annuity. Versus drawdown, an interesting point, and I think it probably is true that you're only better off versus drawdown in 10% of the cases with the same equity mix. So then you've got an argument around, well, if you buy fire insurance or house insurance, you're not upset if your house doesn't burn down. You know, you're glad that you had that protection in case it did. So there is an argument around that's what all insurance products are like. You're paying a premium to protect yourself against the unlikely. Having said that, I think the real strength of the message comes when you start talking about being able to invest more in equities because you're afforded to take more risk. So if you're in drawdown as a 65-year-old and you're relying on that income every year to actually pay your bills, then arguably even a fairly risky customer would want to keep an awful lot of money in fixed interest or cash. Whereas if you knew for certainty, for certain, that you would never get a lower amount of income than the amount that you've guaranteed, perhaps that affords you to invest more in equities, and therefore you've more chance of benefiting from the upside that you talked about there, Ian. So I think versus drawdown, we shouldn't be comparing necessarily drawdown with or without guarantees in the same asset mix. We should be comparing drawdown without guarantees in a more conservative asset mix versus drawdown with guarantees with a more aggressive asset mix. And that's when we can start to see the real value for money for the customer. And perhaps that's the challenge for the industry, to try and explain that to advisors and say, we need to compare like with like. One of the other challenges I think we'll get in the industry is everyone's so price focused. Whereas, and I think Ruth said this as well, the challenge will be to get people to be value focused. So what's the value for money of paying this extra charge for this guarantee? And I think the value for money becomes much clearer if you can assume that you can take more investment risk because you've got that guarantee back in you.
Thank you. Can we have the next contribution from the floor, please?
Well, perhaps while people are collecting their thoughts, I have another one, which I think is sort of continuing along the same lines as the previous question and comment. And that is, we've compared this variable annuity with a conventional annuity. We've compared it with income drawdown. What if you compared it with a mixture of variable conventional annuity and income drawdown? Is it equally as clear in those circumstances? If someone, for example, were to start their retirement with a modest level of conventional annuity and but the majority of their pot in drawdown, but then as time went by, if things happened the way they wanted to, they might gradually increase the proportion which was conventional annuity out of drawdown. How does that compare in terms of value and cost with a variable annuity?
Yep. Good question. And again, that's another way of trying to achieve the same sorts of outcomes, where you say, okay, I want to take some risk, I want the benefit of some of the potential upside from equities, but I also want some of my money absolutely guaranteed. So buying, let's simplify the example a wee bit and just say, why don't you just buy half, spend half your money on the annuity and spend half your money on traditional drawdown? And you could do that. I guess what the authors are arguing in the paper is that it's a more efficient way to take your risk by investing in this type of product that we're proposing, on the basis that if you only take half the investment risk, you only get half the potential upside. If you spend half your money on an annuity, then that's, you get half the death benefits that you would otherwise get in terms of what's coming from the drawdown. So there is an argument there that this is another way to do it. What we're proposing as authors, and I think I speak on behalf of all of us here, is that this is perhaps a more efficient way to take that same level of risk.
Just as an additional comment, unlike some of the authors who are spending most of their day job working on this sort of area, I look at it from something of a distance, and I think one of the challenges often when you get into the detail, it suddenly starts to feel very complex, but at its simplest level, this is a very, very simple product, and it does exactly what I would want a product to do when I'm looking at my retirement. It lets me have control over the pot of money, and it provides an income which protects me against adverse markets, and it protects me against me living too long and running out of funds. And in that sense, at the very simplest level, I think there is a very simple and clear communication that you can give to the customer, albeit at times when we get into the detailed dialogue with distributors, we start comparing one product with another, and we lose that simplicity of the fundamentally what the product is trying to achieve and what it can achieve, which is quite a simple benefit for the end consumer.
Thank you. Can I invite the next contribution from the floor, please?
Sorry, Ronnie again.
My name remains unchanged. Just to respond to a couple of points that Alan made. The house not burning down thing, yeah, that's an old analogy, but my point was that the life cover that you're effectively paying for isn't actually needed. I mean, I'm just, it's an obsession, I think, with IFAs and so on. They prey on people's fear that the insurance company is going to pocket the lot and all the rest of it. So when you do the sums, which, you know, I have a little program which does it, I mean, by the time you reach 75, you can have paid hundreds of thousands of pounds on this life cover. For what? You know, people need life cover when they're buying houses, they've got young families and so on. It's not a given that they actually need the life cover, and that's why I use the term on wasted life cover. I mean, partly wasted because they haven't died, but it was also wasted because it wasn't really needed. The other point you made about waiting till 75 before buying an annuity, again, if you're going to beat them, I mean, I was that actually, of course, in my closing comment. The sooner you buy the annuity and get the longevity guarantee, the better. It doesn't work. It doesn't help if you wait. I mean, particularly in retrospect, because look what's happened to longevity projections and forecasts and so on in the last 10 years. You used the term, I'm sure it's just a sort of, not a slip of the tongue, but you called it conventional drawdown. I think that's partly the problem. I see nothing conventional about drawdown at all. I mean, it seems very odd to me. I'm not doing it. I had people who did do it because they wanted to be flexible while easing into retirement and so on and so forth. But I mean, the president's suggestion of 50-50 conventional annuity and drawdown. Well, again, your product, which had 60% equity backing ratio, my with-profit annuity is 75% on the whole thing. And I've got my longevity guarantee insurance, and I've got a minimum that it can't fall below as well. So all I'm saying is that you can argue on bits and pieces of the structure and guarantees and so on, but some existing products do actually meet a lot of these needs. And if the company wants to, life companies want to sell products, they don't need to necessarily invent new ones if they've got good existing ones which could be better marketed, which I think was the point I was making. Thank you.
Thanks, Ronnie. Yes, good points. And indeed, these products won't be suitable for absolutely everybody. So everybody's going to have their own views on what they want to buy. Some people will want to buy traditional annuities or with-profits annuities, should they still be marketed. I guess one of the difficulties that as a provider we have about selling with-profits annuities these days is the name that with-profits has and the transparency issues around with-profits. So in with-profits, you invest in the product. You are reliant on the company to invest your money well and the way that you expected them to, and the company has discretion over what they will invest in the future. They could change the asset mix of your with-profits fund from 75 to 25, or they could put it up to 100% should they wish, subject to their principles and practices of financial management. So I think there's a real demand out there from advisors and customers, and this won't be for everyone, to be able to invest in a range of funds and still have a guarantee. To be able to choose their own funds perhaps that they would choose if they were in income drawdown without guarantees. So choose the funds that they like anyway, overlay a guarantee on top of that and have complete control over their investments within that, rather than have something which they see is not as transparent as the new breed products would be. So yes, there's pros and cons. I'm not saying this will be the right answer for everybody, but I think there are advantages over the traditional with-profits annuity as well as disadvantages.
So you can have investment-linked annuities in the same way.
Okay, can I invite the next contribution from the floor, please?
Thanks very much. Steve Patterson, as a nod actually, in an IFA, I feel that probably some comments on the question of equity exposure and the inclusion of guarantees in retirement income products might be useful. generally speaking, our experience, which has been fairly widespread in this market, has been that those people who find income drawdown a useful alternative are people who have got significant personal resources out with their pension arrangements. They also tend to be people who are naturally risk takers. And I would have some concern about whether those people would be willing to pay the extra cost of the insurance, given the overall impact that it may have on their financial position. I'd also like to take up Stuart's point about the combination of annuity and income drawdown. And I think giving an example where half the fund is used to buy an annuity and the other half for income drawdown oversimplifies the options that are available. We have an expression in our business that we call PIDSAP. PIDSAP stands for phased income drawdown with selective annuity purchases. And really the point about this is to opportunistically take advantage of market gains throughout the retirement period to convert part or all of the profit into guaranteed income for life. And if that is done systematically in a portfolio with an equity overlay that itself has progressively reduced as clients move through retirement, then significantly better outcomes may be achieved with that ongoing monitoring process. I think the difficulty that many IFAs have is not having the systems capability to enable them to do that. But I think given that it does appear to be accepted that with the same equity exposure, an income drawdown plan should produce better returns, then a more active monitoring and management process should provide the best outcome for those clients for whom income drawdown is suitable in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. We do have a few minutes left for any further contribution from the floor. If anyone has another contribution they wish to make. No. I'm on the point of inviting the closer to close, so it's feel a bit like an auctioneer, you know. going. Okay. Well, I think we're gone then, and I'll invite Ian McGowan of Scottish Widows to close the meeting. I don't know where Ian's just there. Thanks.
Good evening, everyone. The paper starts by reminding us that the concept of guarantees underpinning unit-linked benefits has been with us since the 1970s. It leads me to my first question, why now? Well, the history of with-profits has been mentioned, Alan mentioned it just a few minutes ago. It's been the principal mechanism in the last couple of decades for providing guarantees on unit-linked type policies. But with-profits, as we know, it's declined in popularity, it's less transparent than it might be, returns have been disappointing. There's also the question of modelling. Now, Andrew Smith gave us a little bit of a history lesson there. We're in a much better position now. Variable annuities are tough in terms of risk management modelling. We've made some great progress. But that progress has been very recent. There are recent additions to the UK market. I think what I've seen is that practical experience has been very limited in the UK actuarial profession. I don't think there are many actuaries that are to grips with a range of issues presented in the paper, although Catherine Henshall said that actuaries in Europe are very much looking to the UK to help with that experience. So the paper is very helpful in that regard. It does bring us up to speed. It starts that journey for many of us. For that reason, I'd like to thank the working party for the paper. Also for clarifying for us that these aren't annuities, and of course they're not always variable. The authors take a very practical approach in the paper. The case study they look at is one that Roger Mills said it describes as a combination of greed and fear. People who are looking for upside on investment but want to have a floor on the level of income withdrawal and are happy to pay a price for it. My view is that it is the most likely, the most common application of these types of guarantee, although many contributors picked up that we do need to find ways to apply them, make them attractive for non-pension type benefits. So they're intuitively appealing. Colin and Alan have given some real practical examples to bring that to life. But the practicality of the UK pensions market is a little bit different. For most people, the benchmark is an annuity. Ian Naismith talked through some of the mathematics on that. I wondered whether the working party did assume that the annuity would be the benchmark for most people. After all, they compare it in the paper to income drawdown primarily, rather than to an annuity. I think that for the mass market, that will be the case. I reckon that the trade-off a lower level of starting income, again Ian did the sums, for an uncertain future upside will be a difficult one for people with modest pension pots. At the other end of the spectrum, we have income drawdown. Now, conventional wisdom in drawdown says that investment returns have to be greater than the mortality drag plus the effect of charges. Again, that will be challenging, particularly that the charges under these contracts are high with the cost of guarantees, and there generally has to be a minimum of, say, 30 or 40% in fixed interest. Steve Patterson went through an example of that with some of his clients. But, again, Steve mentioned that drawdown has been used in a much more flexible manner since AD. Clients looking for death benefit and tax advantages, for example, through building up income from tax-free cash and income withdrawals. So if people are looking for drawdown to provide flexibility rather than simply beat an annuity, I do see a place for this type of product. So the positioning of all of this is subtle and important. I think we do have more to do in showing the IFA community and customers where variable annuities work, and just as importantly, where they don't, and we've had lots of discussion on that today. So why have they been slow to take off in the UK, slower than in other countries? Well, I've mentioned annuities, they are still regarded as poor value in many cases, but actually are a very effective solution for many people, something that Ronnie Sloan talked about a little bit. IFAs don't understand where they fit. Ronnie suggested that some what-if examples might help. The industry has more to do here. Maybe we should ask Ronnie for some of his guidance on it. The pension system in the UK also makes life very difficult for us. The authors don't hide the fact that in the paper, their example doesn't work with the constraint of the UK pensions regulatory framework. I understand why they've taken that approach. It avoids us getting bogged down in a lot of detail that could have derailed the paper, so I think it was the right approach to take. But it is left for those of us who enjoy product development, enjoy that challenge in fitting these concepts into quite a tight regulatory constraint. All of that just adds to the fun. The paper goes on in its later sections to talk about sophisticated risk management techniques and accounting considerations. The latter part of the paper gets a bit more complicated, a bit more detailed. It introduces us to a whole army of Greeks, as we call them now. I always think that, as I've understood a few Greeks, a whole lot more of them come over the hill. Ewan Munro and David Hare added a bit of colour through some practical examples of how risk management might be used and the sort of risks we really ought to be considering before embarking on these, at least in any volume. So let me end by thanking the authors. I think it's been a tremendous paper. There's been lots of good contributions today. Variable annuities are here to stay. They do have a part to play, even if not all of us have yet figured it out. For me, it's a matter of when rather than whether they become an accepted part of retirement planning in the UK. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ian. I now invite Colin Wilson to reply on behalf of the authors.
Well, good evening, and thank you very much, everyone, for your comments. I think we had a lot of very helpful comments and questions this evening, and my apologies if I don't answer them all, but we will certainly take them away and think about what you've all said when we come to present this at the Institute in a couple of weeks' time, and also for future reference. I think the comments that we've had this evening fall really into two main areas. One concerns the scope of the actual proposition for the customer and the advice that we need to give the customer in order to help them to understand that proposition and judge it against alternatives. And the second, which maybe we had a bit less discussion on, but certainly some important discussion, was around how the insurance company would manage the risks which was taking on in writing such business. If we start with the first of those, I think it was interesting that at the beginning we had several people actually talking about the whole definition of what a variable annuity is. It is where we started with the paper, and there were obviously some differences of opinion around this, although the focus of the discussion was on its role within the retirement income market. Again, there we had some differences of opinion as to how the product would compare against alternatives which are available at present. I think one thing that didn't come into the discussion, which may be worth thinking about, is asking whether or not people actually have the product that does best meet their needs and handle their risks at present. The vast majority of those who take out conventional annuities take out fixed annuities. There is no income protection in that product, so no inflation protection in that product at all over the length of a very long retirement. If you look at the comparison between an inflation-linked annuity at retirement and a fixed annuity, then probably you can work out that you need to live at least 20 years if inflation turns out to be as expected before the income you'd have from the inflation-linked product matches what you could have had over the whole, you know, each year for the previous 20 years. Does that mean that an inflation-linked annuity is not a good product for someone to take out? Well, there may be not a very high chance of getting a better total income from your inflation-linked annuity, but you're certainly managing the risk of inflation turning out to be higher than expected. So there is an angle of thinking about risk management from the perspective of the individual customer, and not just about a particular probability of one product outperforming another one. So that, if you like, is my summary of where the discussion went on the actual proposition itself. What about the question of how we explain it to the customer, the actual advice piece? It's clear that this is a very real challenge which the whole industry faces. And I would suggest that this is really analogous to the challenge that already exists with some of the products which Ronnie Sloan mentioned. Incidentally, I share his views about the attractions of the with-profits annuity product and potentially the unit-linked annuity product as well. But the reality is that they have proved very difficult to sell into the UK market, partly because the advice is difficult to give. They include the words with-profits, which, as Alan said, is something which means there is discretion on the part of the company and which potentially means that customers are going to be suspicious of that. So there's no doubt that we have a big challenge in presenting to customers exactly what they're getting and how that stacks up against alternatives. That said, it seems to me clear that there will be people for whom this is an attractive proposition when they do understand it, that it has the right sorts of combinations of guarantees and potential upside. It's certainly a useful addition to the armoury of products that can be offered. But we do need to be giving advice, and I think it probably does need to include some stochastic modelling. It isn't just the number of scenarios that we can look at. And I do know that the whole question of stochastic advice is something which the FSA has looked at several years ago now and continues to look at from time to time, but has drawn back from actually coming up with any proposals, really, because of the very difficult nature of accepting what it is that customers will and won't understand. On the question of the hedging of the risks present in these products, again, we had a number of very useful contributions there. I think we should perhaps bear in mind that to some extent, this matches what you and Munro said, the risks are not new to insurance companies. Insurers already have these types of exposures within their business. From that perspective, I don't think they should be managed any differently from the way that some existing business, with-profits business, certainly for how it looks from the shareholders' perspective or the owners of the business perspective. The same sort of risk management should be taking place there. In many cases, it isn't, and that's why this is being looked at as a separate line of business. But those sorts of considerations, the ones about thinking about the whole capacity of the market as well, what it means at a macro level as well as a micro level, are certainly points which are very well made. So I think if I could, to summarise how I see the discussion's gone, I think they're really, as I say, the two different angles, and they both come down to being able to understand and explain where these products do work and where they don't work, both from the perspective of the customer, so that they can understand the proposition and see whether it's something or not they want, and from the perspective of the insurance company, as Colin said, what is the killer scenario? Is there something, a situation here where our management of this product is beyond the capabilities of risk management of the business or exceeds the capital capacity of that business? So again, I'd like to finish by thanking you all for your contributions. I certainly found it a very interesting and informative discussion. As I say, we will take away what's been said, reflect on that, and hopefully we'll be able to respond to some more of those comments when we have a chance to put something in writing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Colin. Well, I think we've had a very interesting and wide-ranging discussion this evening, and I think that in itself is a very good sign of the quality of the paper. So I'd like you to join me in thanking all of the authors for the paper that they've presented this evening. Right, as I said at the start, we don't yet know what meetings are going to be held regarding the proposed merger. It might be Thursday the 27th of March here. On the other hand, it might not. So please watch this space. However, whatever happens to that, we have three Our Changing Futures meetings still to take place. So on Wednesday the 26th of March, here in the Royal College of Physicians of Edinburgh, and slightly unusually for Our Changing Futures, it is an evening meeting. The discussion will be on current topics. There will be refreshments from 5 p.m. with the meeting starting at 5:30, and there will be a drinks reception after the meeting. So that's Wednesday the 26th of March here, 5 for 5:30. Then on Wednesday the 9th of April, we revert to the breakfast scenario for Our Changing Futures, and again it is here. And the topic will be the review on financial advice, and the guest speaker will be Otto Torreson. And then finally, on the 19th of May, there's going to be an Our Changing Futures evening meeting at Resolutions offices in Glasgow. I don't have in front of me what the topic of that meeting is. But I'm sure it will be extremely interesting. And we wait with bated breath. And that meeting will start at 5:30 and last until 7 p.m. So with that, I think I've covered all of the business of the evening, and I now declare the meeting closed.